Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Special bonus episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I wanted to share this with you because I wrote an article the other day on Medium called Onward Christian Soldiers, Are Evangelicals Winning the Culture War? And in case you haven't read that, well, don't worry about it because I'm going to present basically the essence of that article and give you some elements of my own story and some of the things that I'm discovering in my work and my research on Christian nationalism, Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion theology, and all that. But I wanted to share a more personal story of when I was growing up, and I think you'll resonate with this. If you grew up evangelical, if you grew up fundamentalist as a kid, in fact, I read an article the other day on Medium by Dr. Dale O'Neill. It was really good, and he made the point that he was raised in an evangelical church himself, and he said, I was not a born-again Christian, I was a born Christian. And I thought, boy, that says it all right there, what he's talking about. I was, too, a born Christian. I was born in the church. I was raised in the church. I spent my whole life growing up and as an adult in ministry. And I went to Bible college, seminary. I was a pastor. I was a Bible college teacher. So all my adult life, I was a born Christian until I walked away from it all. But I wanted to talk about my experiences growing up in a fundamentalist Christian church outside of Seattle, Washington in the 1970s up until about the early mid-1980s. So if you grew up in church like I did or spent any time around Christians, you will have no doubt sung this particular hymn many, many times.
Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to
if you grew up in church like I did, and the fact that it was sung by kids is even more kind of haunting. And in fact, that's basically what I wanted to talk to you about with the story of Onward Christian Soldiers. The song goes on to say it was actually written in the 19th century. There's some of the other verses. At the name of Jesus, Satan's armies flee. On then, Christian soldiers, on to victory. Like a mighty army moves the church of God. Well, I grew up in a fundamentalist church of Christ. We were located just outside of Seattle, Washington, as I said, in the 1970s. And I can remember, in fact, it's a little bit triggering, even hearing that song being sung again just now. But there were many times when that song came up during our church services and we belted out that classic hymn. Now, when I was a kid, I did not take the time to analyze the sort of martial aspects of that song. I didn't evaluate these elements of spiritual warfare. I mean, the song talks about, at the name of Jesus, Satan's armies flee. And what does that say about this sort of narrative that we, the church, were an army battling against the armies of Satan? We didn't evaluate it, no way. But what we knew, though, was that the church was inevitably going to enjoy that victory. We didn't have the critical thinking capacity. We couldn't question. We didn't question what we were being taught. We just said, hey, it's all true. The Bible says it's true. Our parents say it's true. We trusted everybody. Our pastor, he reinforced the whole thing too. And I would say now, looking back on it, it's more like indoctrination of defenseless children than anything else. But all I knew then was that we were the church of God. We were part of that mighty army moving forward to some sense of inevitable victory. Now let's talk about our church. They did a fantastic job of brainwashing, indoctrinating us kids into accepting this mentality as well. I can remember as a kid singing this particular song that you'll undoubtedly remember if you grew up in church like I did.
I may never march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the artillery. I may
singing that one. I sure did remember singing that as a kid. In Sunday school, right before our classes, we'd sing that song. And of course, what made it more fun was every time at the end of the chorus, you know, where they shout out, "Yes, sir." We had all the motions too. When the song said, "I may never march in the infantry," we would march in place like soldiers, ride in the cavalry. We'd pretend like we were riding a horse with the bit and the bridle, shooting the artillery. We'd clap our hands and simulate a cannon shot. When we talked about flying or zooming over the enemy, we'd spread our arms like airplanes and run around, and we'd shout out when the chorus came around, "I am in the Lord's army," and we'd shout and we'd salute, "Yes, sir." And once again, there you go. We're never thinking about the martial implications of this song. We just had fun. We just loved it. It was a high energy, fun song with motions and everything. Now, looking back on it, it sure seemed like we were winning that culture war. When I was about 10, singing those songs in church and Sunday school, now, I didn't read Newsweek magazine, but I found out that they dubbed 1976, the year I was 10, they called it the Year of the Evangelical. And this was off the back of a Gallup poll. And this is something that really was a new thing. There was a kind of a whole voting block that had been undiscovered or untapped really up until that time. But in 1976, they started getting together, that evangelical block. They had just elected Jimmy Carter to the presidency. And he was a self-confessed Christian. And just 4 years later, though, they kind of turned on Carter. And that evangelical block ended up supporting Ronald Reagan for president. And there's a famous statement. Ronald Reagan spoke at the National Affairs Campaign Address on Religious Liberty in Dallas, Texas, in August of 1980 to these evangelicals. He said, "Now, I know this is a nonpartisan gathering, and so I know that you can't endorse me, but I only brought that up because I want you to know that I endorse you and what you're doing." That was what Reagan had to say. And the place went nuts. And there were people in there like Jerry Falwell Sr., his Moral Majority movement. That started in 1979. And really the major aim of the Moral Majority was to mobilize a huge voting base of evangelical fundamentalist Christians and Catholics alike to help get Ronald Reagan elected, among other things. But you know, the Christians that I was hanging around with back in 76, the bicentennial, we weren't looking to establish some kind of theocracy, some sort of theocratic kingdom. But of course, those who were pushing a lot of the stuff that was going on in terms of the evangelicals and getting them involved in politics, they did have a very theocratic vision, and they were using people like us as loyal foot soldiers in this culture war. Now, we voted Republican. You know, as far as we knew, Christians were Americans. We were Republicans. That's just kind of the way it was. We listened to Dr. James Dobson, Focus on the Family. Every day we'd listen to him when I was at home as a kid. And he was adept at spreading this message of fear. What's going on? You got to be vigilant. You got to watch out for secular humanism in our society. And for people like Dobson, part of winning that culture war, part of battling against the encroachment of secular humanism was, of course, that Christians needed to get involved in the political process. I can remember hearing him on the radio as a kid. He would keep us abreast of what was going on in the political arena, you know, talking about what's coming up in terms of votes and bills and things that were coming up either in particular states, or he'd talk about bills that were being proposed in the federal government. And somehow this all related to this focus on the family, and this was important. Anything that came along that had to do with undermining what he saw as the traditional role of the family, he needed to make us aware of it and get us mobilized. He would say, "You need to call your congressperson, call your senator, flood their lines, fax lines, phone lines, express your outrage or your support for a particular bill." And that's what we did. You know, my parents were heavily involved in Republican politics. And so we were showing that we were a force to be reckoned with. But now, what about this culture war? What were the contours of it? Now, when I was a kid, going back to when I was 10 or 11, I can remember we had another pastor by this time the second pastor of the church that I grew up in, Pastor David, and he would talk from the pulpit about the moral decline of America. He'd talk about this in his sermons, and I can still remember. I don't remember anything Pastor David said, but this one line always stuck with me all these years later. He would say something like this. He'd say, in America today, we're seeing faceless politicians, and we're seeing voiceless preachers everywhere. I still don't know what he meant. What's a faceless politician, a voiceless preacher? Maybe that was the cause of the moral decay. As a kid, I wasn't sure, but I was sure concerned about these voiceless preachers and faceless politicians out there. So who was to blame? This was the question for this moral rot. Who was to blame for this thing that was dooming us all? We were going downhill. But this is the point. We were going to go downhill unless, that is, someone took a stand. Someone needs to take a stand for decency, integrity, the truths of the Bible, and the American way. It was all lumped in together. All we knew, though, as kids growing up in this context in this mid-1970s, we were the Lord's army. We had to do something to stop this encroachment of secular humanism, whatever that was. What's interesting, of course, is that we didn't know what secular humanism even was. But it's interesting to look back on it now and say, this was giving us an enemy. This was giving us something to demonize. This was presenting an us versus them scenario that we bought into. We were the good guys, and those secular humanists out there, they were the bad guys. And along with that, we grew up hearing this sort of narrative of America's founding. We were told that America needed to return to its Christian roots, its Christian heritage, back to a day when America was a Christian nation. It was founded by Christian men, our founding fathers. And there was this storyline that the godless atheists, I can remember them vilifying people like Madeline Murray, and you know, she helped get God kicked out of public schools, kicked out of the public square, and we need to bring him back and bring the Bible back. And this was the whole sort of narrative. And somehow that was, I guess, secular humanism. I had no idea what it was as a kid. I just knew it was a bad thing. The message was clear, though, to us kids. We had a sort of an instinctive grasp on this idea that there was a culture war going on. We were in a desperate battle. There was a culture war for the hearts, the souls, the minds of Americans. But back then, though, like I said, it was 1976. It was the year of the evangelical. We heard these warnings about America's moral decline, but it looked like we were winning the war. Things were looking up. Wasn't victory just around the corner? But this is the question I want to ask. What would victory look like? If you'd asked us then, in 1976, when I was 10 years old, I think certainly the Christians that I was hanging around with then, they would have said Christian victory is something like this. It's about spreading the gospel of Christ all over the world. The way we saw it, we were going to win the war. We weren't going to establish some sort of theocracy, but we were going to do it through conversionism, you know, proselytizing others, evangelizing our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, our relatives. We were going to be involved in foreign missions. Eventually, the whole world would be converted to Christianity. I guess it was working. I mean, and there was this sort of message. I can remember as a kid, missionaries would come in. They'd be home on furlough. They'd come back from some foreign mission field where they'd been serving. They'd come to speak in our church. They'd put on a presentation, usually at a Sunday evening service. And then we'd have these ice cream socials. If you grew up in church, you can remember those. That was probably my favorite part. You know, I couldn't wait to make myself sick on the ice cream. But even then, during the presentation, I was still captured by these slides. And it wasn't a PowerPoint slideshow. That didn't exist back then. There was no internet. They had slides in a projector, in a carousel, projected up on a screen in front of the congregation. And they'd show these pictures, these slides, and they were amazing. You know, most of us hadn't even traveled beyond our state, our home state. We were just stunned. These pictures are flashing across the screen, far away places, you know, Africa, China, South America, wherever these missionaries had been. And there was this narrative. They were sharing their stories. They were saying that the gospel wasn't just impacting them, of course, getting them saved. It was having an economic impact. It was having an impact in other ways in these really kind of disadvantaged countries. The gospel, this was the good news. It was making a huge impact all over the world. It was kind of spreading like a tide. And I can remember walking away thinking as a kid, man, secular humanism, forget it. It doesn't stand a chance. We're winning this thing. And I can remember even decades later, I went to a conservative Bible college down in Portland in Oregon. They really emphasized, they championed this kind of mentality. Every year, about halfway through the spring term, they'd have what they call Missions Week, and all classes, all activities were canceled for the whole week. You had to go to every session, every day. It was mandatory. You'd hear lectures by missionaries. There'd be workshops that you had to go to. They'd have booths set up in the basement of the church. You had to spend hours going through these booths that were manned by missions agencies. Of course, they were trying to recruit us to become missionaries. It was mandatory, like I said. If you didn't go and you skipped the sessions, you actually would get into academic trouble. If you missed it, you had to go. And I always remember hearing these things, you're hearing these missionaries speak, and there was this sort of overarching message that these Christians on the foreign mission fields, they were kind of the front lines of the war. They were sort of first-class Christians. They were at the top of God's tier in terms of ministry vocations. Now, I never became a foreign missionary myself. I was a pastor and then a Bible college teacher, but I did go to Mexico. I went to Africa. We went to Kenya and built a church. We built houses down in Mexico, you know, and I taught people. I trained people to go into the mission field. So I felt like I was doing my own, you know, sort of part to win this war for Jesus in my own little way. But now let's go back to when I was a kid. Going back to when I was 10 years old, there was a darker side, of course, to this winning the war for God mentality that I'd learned as a kid. When I was about 9, 10, we were singing all those songs, I'm in the Lord's Army, you know, Onward Christian Soldiers and all that. Our church showed the movie A Thief in the Night. Now, if you grew up in the church, you'll remember this. It was sort of an end times apocalyptic movie about a person or a group of people after the rapture occurs. They miss it because they're not true Christians, and they have to then face the 7 years of tribulation. And I was absolutely terrified. I was traumatized as a kid. I kept thinking, man, I'm going to be left behind in the event of the rapture. And I knew for sure I didn't want to miss it. I didn't want to have to face the 7 year tribulation and all the rest of it. Looking back on it now, I can see from the sort of vantage of hindsight and growing up as an adult, I internalized this message though. I came away thinking, okay, let's figure this out. Once Christ returns, he takes his own followers, his true believers, back to heaven with him. At that point, everything's gone. Divine protection, spiritual, physical protection, gone. Now, if you missed the rapture because of your lack of faith, guess what? You're on your own. It's too late. There's no going back. And what happens then, according to the plot of the movie, and then there was some sequels to it as well, you have these demonic forces, satanic forces, operating through the leadership of the beast and the Antichrist. And we were always looking for the Antichrist. He was going to be in charge of the world. And it was going to be a terrible time. You had chaos. You had plagues, famine, war, pestilence, all these things covering the earth. If you didn't take the mark of the beast, you were going to be executed. And for some reason, they used a guillotine. And I can well remember as a kid, 9, 10, 11 years old, seeing that scene of a person getting their head chopped off in a guillotine. That's incredibly traumatic. And I certainly didn't want that to happen to me. Now, we knew that Christ was going to return after the tribulation, returning with his armies. He was going to win. There was going to be a big showdown at Armageddon, and he was going to defeat the armies of Satan. But you know what? If you're one of the unfortunates left behind to face the tribulation, that's kind of cold comfort, isn't it? So here I am, faced with all this anxiety. Even though I'd grown up in the church, I went to the pastor. I saw the movie. I went to see him, and I said, look, how can I become a Christian? I don't want to get left behind in the rapture. And he says, all right, well, let's pray the sinner's prayer and then get you baptized. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to do this transaction. I'll be in the club. My worries, my problems will be laid to rest. Isn't that right? Well, unfortunately, things weren't quite that simple. Our Church of Christ, we had this doctrine called baptismal regeneration. And basically the doctrine is that in order to become a Christian, part of the formula, part of the equation, you've got to undergo full immersion water baptism. That's, of course, the Baptistic tradition, but it had to be done with a formula, a Trinitarian formula. The person who had to be qualified, they would, you know, baptize you, and they'd say, I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They'd dunk you in the water, and the deed was done. So a few weeks after that, after I'd approached the pastor, I finished the job. I got baptized, my father, one Sunday evening in the church baptistry. Now, in that culture war, I'm thinking, okay, clearly I've signed the enlistment papers. I've enlisted in the Lord's army. I'd been singing about it for so many years. I was on the winning side. There's no question about it. Life was good. That is, for a while, for a very short amount of time. After I got baptized, not many months after that, I kind of had this mountaintop experience, and then I kind of dropped into the shit because the anxiety started. The trauma returned. This issue of missing the rapture, facing the tribulation, I thought that would all go away when I got baptized. I was definitely a loyal foot soldier in the Lord's army. But what I discovered was that the, quote, good news of the gospel was actually anything but good news. It put me into a system of legalism. It actually introduced a whole new problem that caught me completely unawares. It led to years of anxiety, religious trauma, rapture anxiety. And this was the question that really, you know, kind of plagued my 10 or 11-year-old mind. How was I supposed to know that I was definitely, truly saved? How did I know I was a genuine born-again Christian? Could I lose my salvation? What if I had been fooling myself? What if the whole conversion thing wasn't real? I kind of thought, well, wait a minute, maybe my dad, because he baptized me, it wasn't the pastor, maybe that invalidated the formula. Maybe it wasn't right somehow. And I kept going down that line of doubt. I was overthinking it. I started realizing, wait a minute, if I'm not a true believer, I'm just a deluded hypocrite. What's going to happen if the rapture does occur? Because we heard that all the time, that Jesus is coming soon, like a thief in the night. He could come anytime. We just don't know. And I could not face the possibility when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, being left behind, facing those 7 years of tribulation alone, by myself, no family, no friends, in a post-apocalyptic hellscape. I had to make sure. So what I did was, I was overthinking it, had all this anxiety, I guess PTSD, I'd say now. You know, I didn't know what to do. So I'd just make sure I had this insurance. I'd pray the sinner's prayer virtually every night just to make sure, confess all my sins, recommit myself to Christ over the next few years. But you know what? Things weren't working too well. I was having doubts. I was having struggles, anxiety. I thought, man, this is not working. I'm a failure. I'm definitely not a Christian. Well, I went to get rebaptized again when I was 13. We had this other pastor, as I mentioned before, Pastor David, the guy who used to talk about the faceless politicians and the voiceless preachers. He baptized me again at 13. I thought, this is going to work now because he's a definite pastor. He's qualified. If anybody's qualified, we did it according to the formula. But you know what? A few years later, again, I couldn't make it work. Around about 16 or 17, I just quit the whole church. I walked away from the whole thing. But then I came back to it, I think in my early 20s. I was getting involved in actually playing in a Christian metal band out of Seattle. And one of the guys asked me, are you even a Christian? And I said, no. So I started going to church with him in my early 20s. I got saved. And then a few years later, I got baptized again for the third and final time. I was about 25 or so. I was a youth pastor. I was going to that Bible college down in Portland in Oregon. And you know, it's funny looking back on it now, it seems like this sort of initial enlistment process, it wasn't so effective as I had counted on when I was 10. And you know, I've always thought about this. Why doesn't this supposedly all-powerful God that Christians are serving and obeying, why doesn't he make it more clear? Why doesn't he do a better job of making sure that people's doubts, our fears, our anxiety were laid to rest? You know, isn't it in his best interest? That's always kind of stuck with me. Well, going back to when I was 10, another real significant experience went down around the same time. I switched from the public school that I'd been going to from kindergarten up to about fourth grade, year four, as they say in this country. I started going to a small Christian school. This was located just outside of Seattle, Washington. Now, again, as a kid, I didn't know anything back then. I didn't know anything about the modern institution of Christian education, the homeschooling movement, Christian Reconstructionism, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that whole movement, I see that now, it was playing and still is playing a huge part in this sort of Christian vision, this winning the culture war, taking dominion. And I talked about this before in another episode, The Psychology of the Pawn. I was just a pawn in a much larger game of which I was completely, totally unaware at the time. Now, going back to my public school time, I'd actually been doing pretty well. I'd excelled academically. I was way ahead in reading. I was a voracious reader. I was a good writer. I'd been put ahead about two grades. so I could be with other kids who were at a higher level, reading, writing, had friends. I was enjoying playing sports. We did have a lot of issues, some of the problems that were going on in my home life. If you want to catch that episode, by the way, me and my sister Valerie did it a couple years ago. I talked about, and she shared her story, we talked about growing up in a fundamentalist home, growing up where my parents raised us according to the Bill Gothard teachings, which caused a lot of problems. And this is right around that same time that my sister Valerie got pregnant when she was about 17 and got kicked out and went into foster care and was forced to give her daughter up for adoption as part of this whole thing. So that was going on at the same time. But I was a pretty happy kid. So I switch over to this Christian school in fifth grade. All of my buddies from church were going there. Most of them had gone to this little Christian school. I'm thinking it's going to be better. It's going to be a success. Actually, it proved to be more of a disaster. Rather than excelling academically, socially, my life started going backwards rather than forwards. It was the first time when I was in seventh grade, I experienced bullying. It was for the first time in my life. Nothing was done about it. Teachers did nothing to do, you know, to curb it. Staff did nothing. That, of course, caused a lot of trauma, a lot of anxiety. No one likes being bullied. I was struggling with doubts, as I was saying, around this same time about my faith. I've got this bullying situation going on. I'm having a hard time fitting in, even though I had friends there, as well as these problems going on at home. And, of course, I get into some fights. I'm just sort of acting out. I guess I see it now. I was a really troubled kid. And what happens? Get swats from the principal, you know, and I did that. That happened to me several times. That was painful. That was embarrassing. That was traumatic. That's how this Christian school handled the discipline of a kid who was really obviously having some problems. No one ever said, hey, what's going on in your home life? What's going on in your faith life? No, they just gave me swats, which I guess nowadays is probably illegal. So as a matter of fact, I think now looking back on it, academically, all of us students must have suffered. I mean, the teachers there, they were completely unqualified outside of like one area, education. You know, we had a teacher, for example, she had a bachelor's degree in English. That was her teaching specialty. Her certification was in English, but she had to teach math and creative writing and science and all these other subjects, history and all the rest of it, as well as all the other teachers. They had all the kids all day long, and they just went from subject to subject. Most of them are totally unfamiliar with. They're just reading one chapter ahead in the textbook. They've got no business teaching, and I think a lot of small private schools, that's probably the case for most teachers, and there's no way you can convince me that that is a good thing, that you're teaching other specialty subjects that you have no knowledge of or no background in education. That cannot be a good thing, either for the teacher or the students. But there's one thing that this tiny little Christian school really did well, in terms of emphasis anyway, that was the Bible. Every day in class, we'd have some sort of Bible component, Bible study. We had weekly chapels every Thursday morning, and there again, we were singing those martial songs that I knew from growing up in church, from Sunday school, I'm in the Lord's Army, Onward Christian Soldiers, and all that. Every morning we had the Pledge of Allegiance. We'd say the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, one nation under God. And that was the thing, our hands on hearts. And the other part of it was, too, we'd pledge allegiance to the Bible. I don't know if you know this, but there is actually a Pledge of Allegiance to the Bible. And it goes like this. I pledge allegiance to the Bible, God's holy word. I will make it a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I will hide its words in my heart that I might not sin against God. That's the Pledge of Allegiance to the Bible. And we'd say that right along with the American Pledge of Allegiance. So what this Christian school was doing, they were seamlessly merging patriotism, fundamentalist Christianity in one unbroken link. And again, kids, we're not even thinking about it. We're not questioning it. As far as we were concerned, being a Christian equals being an American. That's kind of how it works. Together, they're in concert with our church. This is the whole context. They're doing a great job. They're indoctrinating an entire generation of kids. And this is back in the 70s. They're putting out these loyal foot soldiers. We're going to go out into the world. We're in the Lord's army. We're going to carry the fight to the enemy. But looking back on it now, I'd say they're doing a great job of producing generations of loyal foot soldiers for that culture war. Now let's talk about the Rush-Dooney connection. What's this all about? Well, in 2019, I'd say late in 2019, many decades after I'd walked away from the church, I'd walked away from Christianity, That's when I came across the name of a certain R.J., that is Roussos John Rushdoony. He is what is known as the father of Christian Reconstructionism. Now, let's talk a little bit about the life, the activities of Rushdoony. You got to go back all the way to the 1960s. Now, among other things, back as far back as the 60s, he was a tireless advocate for this idea of Christian education and specifically homeschooling. What was Rushdoony doing? Well, in the 70s, in the 80s, he was traveling tirelessly the length, the breadth of America. Who was he talking to? He was speaking to pastors. He was talking to churches, home groups, business leaders, Christian colleges, seminaries. He was advocating, I would say, two aspects of this vision of Christian Reconstructionism. First, he was advocating for Christian parents to withdraw their children from what he would call statist or government education. And secondly, he was looking to establish specifically Christian education nationwide, and that really became the basis or the genesis of the Christian homeschooling movement. And why he's so important, beyond his sort of voluminous writings, he also was a key legal expert. He served as an expert in many, many state homeschooling court cases. And what he was doing was he was advocating for the rights of parents to teach their children at home, because a lot of it came about where the state said, well, if you want to homeschool your kids, there's nothing illegal about that, but you as a parent, you've got to have the same academic credentials as any school teacher in a public school. And Rushdoony fought many, many court cases, and that's what sort of led to all these movements of sort of legal arms defending the rights of parents to teach their kids at home despite having a lack of academic credentials. And basically the Christian school, the homeschooling movements, they wouldn't exist as they do today without the work, the efforts of Rushdoony. Now, you take Rushdoony and you go, okay, his influence has spread. Look, for example, at attorney Michael Ferris. He's one example of a person who's taken Rushdoony's Reconstructionist vision. He's extended it further. Who's Michael Ferris? Well, he was originally part of the Concerned Women for America. He served as an attorney for them, and also he worked with Dr. J. Grimstead. He was on the steering committee of the Coalition on Revival. And basically, that was an effort by Dr. Grimstead to take Rushdoony and other Dominion theologians' ideas into the evangelical and charismatic mainstream. So Michael Ferris was part of the Coalition on Revival. And off the back of those experiences, Ferris goes on to found the Homeschooling Legal Defense Association, the HSLDA, in 1983. What's the purpose of the HSLDA? This is part of that legal sort of front, the legal arm of the homeschooling, the Christian homeschooling, I should say, movement that Rushdoony and others were fighting for 10, 15, 20 years prior to this. What's the HSLDA doing? They are fighting for, or they have fought for, and in most cases they've won those legal battles that I was talking about for the rights of homeschoolers. What else do? They provide homeschooling curriculum, and now because they've basically won virtually all of those battles about the rights of parents to teach kids, even though they may not have academic credentials, now what they're doing is they're advocating their members and the kids in homeschooling to become active in the political arena. They're saying, we don't want any of these rights that we fought so hard for to be repealed, so you need to become involved. And they have training for both the parents as well as the students. Now, this is what's interesting. You're going to struggle to find Rushdoony's name on homeschooling curriculum, on their websites, but his fingerprints are all over the movement. You have to do your homework. He's there. His talking points, his terminology, his theology, Reconstructionist Dominion theology, is all over this movement, but it's been sanitized or filtered through, and his name has been kind of scrubbed of it. And this is because a lot of the stuff Rushdoony said was really controversial. He was the one talking about the death penalty for homosexuals and incorrigible children and people practicing other religions and any other violations of the Old Testament law. So his stuff kind of got sanitized, but as I say, his fingerprints are all over it. Now let's go back to Michael Ferris. As he's working to advance guys like Rushdoony's vision in the year 2000, he and some others, they helped found Patrick Henry College. That's located in Virginia, but it's very close to Washington, D.C. It's the first Christian college in America specifically aimed at receiving homeschool graduates. They say statistics are hard to come by on some of this, but about 75-80% of their student body is made up of homeschooling kids. So it's a pipeline for homeschool kids into higher education. Now, PHC, Patrick Henry College, their stated vision, you can read this on their website, we're about training up godly men and women. We want to sort of inculcate them with this thing called the biblical worldview that's supposed to affect every area of life. Their vision is to send them out after they've been trained up to become specifically Christian leaders in high positions of influence in America and in the world. Now, you can read about these guys even during the George W. Bush administration, just a few years after the college was founded, as early as 2004. You find PhD graduates and students serving as interns during the George W. Bush administration, as well as in legal arms. They served as interns and still are serving as interns for Supreme Court justices, for conservative Republican congresspeople, senators. Now there's even more inside of course, the Trump administration. You find them all over the place, along with interns from places like Bob Jones University as well. So although he died just the year after PHC was founded in 2001, I'm sure if he were alive today, Rush Dooney would be pleased with the work of guys like Michael Ferris, others who have taken up this dominionist kind of mantle. They've passed it along. And really for them, it's about the long game. Their vision is to train up generations of children in a homeschooling or Christian education context, release them out to institutions like Patrick Henry or Bob Jones University, which incidentally, if you look at Bob Jones, they are a major supplier of homeschooling curriculum. Go look up BJU Press. They give all sorts of stuff out to homeschoolers across America. So, of course, a lot of kids end up going to Bob Jones University because they've been raised with BJU Press curriculum. So looking at it from the perspective of a Christian parent who's homeschooled their kids, places like PHC and BJU, they're just extension campuses for homeschoolers. And this is the scheme. This is Rush Dooney's vision. These future leaders, they're going to take dominion over the world. They're going to establish it. They're going to order it according to biblical principles or biblical worldview, or even in the case more extreme, Rush Dooney's vision was according to biblical law, setting up a society whereby everyone has to obey the tenets of the Mosaic law. Of course, not every kid who's homeschooled in America or other parts of the world are part of this Reconstructionist Dominionist agenda. There's a lot of parents out there who just want to homeschool their kids because they want an alternative to the state education, or maybe their kids are getting bullied or something like that. It's completely secular, has nothing to do with Christianity or religion. But the movement has been dominated by organizations like the HSLDA. And I think a lot of people fail to realize is that connection that certainly the Christian homeschooling movement owes to people like Rush Dooney, and of course we know Michael Ferris and other major influencers like Doug Phillips of the now defunct Vision Forum, Greg Harris, the list goes on. There's so many people, but I never knew who Rush Dooney was. When I was a kid, as I was saying before, I grew up in this fundamentalist church in Seattle. I was going to this little Christian school. I never heard of his name. I didn't hear of his name until last year sometime. But as I said before, I was a part of a larger movement of which I was completely, totally unaware. I was a pawn on the chessboard. My parents raised us, like I was saying earlier, according to Bill Gothard's teaching. I didn't know that his biblical patriarchy agenda, the modesty culture and all that, the ATI, Advanced Training Institute, Christian homeschooling curriculum, that's part of Rush Dooney's vision too. I just knew, hey, I was doing my part to help the church win the culture war. I was an indoctrinated, loyal foot soldier. So let's wrap this up. This is the question. Are evangelicals winning the culture war? The people like myself and so many others were a part of. I mean, we're talking about decades ago, back in the early, mid-70s. Now, if you ask a guy like Michael Ferris, others in the Christian right, they'd say, absolutely, yes. We're winning, especially now in the case of the evangelical-friendly Trump era. We're seeing the rise of Christian nationalism like never before. They have made unbelievable inroads into politics and media and all sorts of other areas of influence, but it's been a long time. That's what I wanted to emphasize. This has been a very long time, decades in the making. So what can you and I do about it? Well, the first most important thing is becoming educated. Become educated about this movement. See how it works. That's the most important aspect to this whole thing. What's going on? You need to learn about what's happening. Now, your average church-going evangelical, sitting in that church pew, that church seat somewhere, you know, in any town, USA, they probably never heard of Rush Dooney or any of these other people either. But just like I was, they're being manipulated as pawns. This is something that Catherine Stewart and I talked about. She said that they're viewing churches like cells. They want to get pastors mobilized because they know these Christian right organizations like Tony Perkins and the Family Research Council and so many others, if they can get pastors on their side, the pastors will influence their parishioners to vote a certain way, to get involved in politics, to sort of push this agenda of Christian nationalism, the myth of Christian America, and all the rest of it. They're being manipulated. They're like pawns, just like I was, as I've tried to illustrate in this episode, by forces outside of their knowledge, outside of their control. They've been recruited. They've been used like loyal foot soldiers for this nationalist agenda. The fact is, nobody wants to be a pawn in someone else's larger game. So I'm trying to get the word out there and educate people. Hopefully, this has been a helpful episode for you to kind of maybe put some of the pieces together. Me sharing my own story of what it was like to grow up in a fundamentalist religious context back in the mid and late 1970s when it was the year of the evangelical. We were going to win that culture war. And indeed, that movement has borne its fruit. What we're seeing now in the Trump era and these all sorts of Christian nationalist organizations that have been supported by his administration, this is all coming to fruition. Where is it all going? I'm not sure, but we need to be aware and educated about this movement. So I'm just hoping to get the word out there. All right, so let's wrap this up. If you want to follow me, you can get a hold of me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can send me a DM there. Let me know what you thought of this episode. I also wanted to announce something really, really exciting. If you're interested in learning more about this movement, Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion Theology, Seven Mountains Mandate Theology, the Christian Right, how it all comes together, homeschooling, all the rest of it, I am going to be doing a 5-week course in the month of June, just coming up in a few weeks here. This is going to be a paid online course. We're going to do it via Zoom calls and on Nearpod. We're going to do an episode every week for an hour, probably on Sundays, 7 p.m. UK time. I'm going to be putting some more information up on my website, which is mindshiftpodcast.co.uk. So we'll take a deep dive every week into these episodes. If you are interested in taking that course, it's $100. That's the introductory price that I'm offering. For those of you that support me on Patreon, I will offer a discount as well. I'm going to limit it to about maybe 5-6 people to start so we can have a nice small group. And there'll be a quiz every week. We'll have some reading to do. And so it's going to be a full-on online course. I think it's going to be really good. I'm looking forward to doing that starting in early June. I'll have more information on that, like I say, on my website. So thanks for joining me on this journey. We want to march away. We want to get out of that army of the Lord. I'm going to get out. So I'll see you later. Next week is an episode with Conway and Siegelman, and we're going to be picking up on some of these things that I've been talking about in this episode, as well as with some other people. I've also got David from The Graceful Atheist, which will drop after Conway and Siegelman. I've also got some really good interviews coming up, too, in the next few weeks. I'll be talking to Dr. Michael McVicker, who wrote the book on R.J. Rush Dooney and Christian Reconstructionism, as well as Dr. Milton Gaither, who wrote probably the best book on the history of homeschooling in America. So we're going to pick up again in more detail the influences of people like Rush Dooney and Ferris and others on the modern homeschooling movement. So you're not going to want to miss those two episodes with Michael McVicker and Milton Gaither coming up as well. So thanks for joining me on this special bonus episode. I'll see you soon with Conway and Siegelman.